So welcome, everyone, tonight. Tonight is the fifth talk in the series of six talks on the shadow, and tonight's talk is entitled The Shadow Within the Story. The Shadow Within the Story. As I often like to do, I just want to mention a science lecture that I went to recently, and the physicist was talking about some of the bizarre qualities of science, and he mentioned one experiment that he said electrons, one of the building blocks of and the foundation of the materiality of life, the electrons, they have a spin, and they pair, and one spin is in a positive direction and one spin is in a negative direction, and occasionally the electrons have an ambivalent spin, so they change spins. They go from positive to negative, and the one that's paired with it changes in accordance with how that one changes. So he said they've done an experiment now where they've taken those two paired electrons and separated them with infinite distance. And he said then one of those pairs was stimulated so that the spin would change from a negative to a positive direction. And what happened was that the spin of the other electron, even though it was infinitely far apart, changed instantaneously with the direction of that new spin. And he says it wasn't at the speed of light. It wasn't that this changed and then a few milliseconds later, this one changed. It was instantaneous. And he said, this makes no sense whatsoever. And then he said, it's not for science to make sense. It's for us to make sense of science. Science just records the truth. And it's up to us to accommodate that truth. So, you see, I for one, do not believe that the fundamental building blocks of life, electrons, that life itself has to be composed of those fundamental building blocks, and therefore the laws that govern it, govern one have to govern the other. So if that's a fact, how did we come to see the world in such different ways, in such separate and isolated ways? How did we get from this, to the multiplicity of things? I find that a very interesting question. Maybe it's because we're afraid of seeing it in its true composition, governed by its true laws. The mind is capable of seeing anything it wants to see. In fact, when I was a undergraduate, I remember an experiment that in which they changed the vision of the eye so that special pair of glasses were worn so that when you looked at the glasses, the top part of your vision would be standing on its head and the bottom part would be standing as it normally does, so that it would invert half of the image. And very quickly, within a few minutes, the brain, although it was looking through these lenses, changed it around so that it was on familiar ground, seeing everything whole and standing upright. So there is an amazing capacity within our minds to shift reality to suit its needs. So we have to question the way we see, because we're seeing to suit our needs. That may not be the truth. In fact, science and mysticism are pointing in the direction of the electrons. So what is it? What's happening here? And why does it seem so different to us? Well, that's what we're exploring in this series. We're looking at the way the mind takes safe harbor within itself. And what's the fallout from that safe harbor? From that corridoring itself off? What is the life lived when it's lived not in conjunction with the truth of the electron, but in the abstract truth of the mind's convincing view? What happens? Because it's not good enough to say, well, electrons are that way, so I'm that way too, that's it. We have to find out where we have misplaced and misrepresented the fundamental interconnection of life. We have to go back and look for ourselves and see for ourselves firsthand how we have misconstrued those laws. And that's what a spiritual journey is about. In one way of saying it, we have to make the ego feel safe enough to relax. That's what a spiritual journey does. Because that's the only thing that needs to be convinced. And so we can't just stay within the safe pasture of what the ego wants, or it will never be able to explore and prove to itself first that the vision it holds of the view is inherently wrong, and secondly, the wrongness of that vision or the rightness of interconnection holds some basic safety and integrity that the other view can never possibly hold. So we were looking at this in terms of the shadow. We could look at it in terms of anything, but the shadow has a kind of drama to it, and it has a kind of darkness to it, and it is a subject that has enough drama that will wake us up, perhaps, shake us a little, like death, get our attention, so that we can look and see whether some of the ways that we hold life are in fact disoriented. And so we have been exploring that. We've been exploring how it is that the mind, when it doesn't feel safe and feels fear, involves a whole pattern of reactivity. And through that pattern of reactivity, in which on the safe side of that reaction is a pulling away or a constriction or a contraction. And on the unsafe side of that is an unknown quality or quantity or event or experience. And that we try to adjust the parameter of that so that we stay separated and isolated from that which seems to be so fearful. And in the process of that, the shadow is created, the darkness, the unknown, that which is mistrusted, that which is not me, and the sense of I is also formed, safely, securely, intact, within the comforts of its own knowing. And what happens between those, that moment of reactivity, that pullback moment, is something very interesting. An idea occurs. That's all. It's not as if we can pull back from reality. How can reality pull back from itself? It's nonsensical to even think that way. It's an idea that pulls back from reality, because that's the only thing that can, you see? It's the only thing we've got at our disposal that can contradict what is happening. It's a concept, it's an idea. It shouldn't be this warm in here. There's warm, there's the temperature in the room, and then it shouldn't be this warm in here. What does that have to do with anything? But it has to do with everything when we are totally embodied in that idea. That idea has a whole representation all of its own, a whole personalization, a whole impostering. Impostering. Somebody told me I make up words. And said that there was actually some kind of a diagnosis for that, which I could make up a word for it, but I won't. I always thought I was being creative. Now I'm sick. So I think it's very interesting to see how, which is really what I want to bring us into tonight, how thought has a whole world all of its own. It has a whole context, a whole view, a whole relationship, a whole narrative that describes everything. And from that safe harbor of that narrative, we can then sit down and supposedly relax, or at least that's the intention of the field, to be Ferdinand the Bull and to actually lay down in the pasture. The problem is we keep getting stung by the bee and kicking and screaming in the pasture, and we can't figure it out. Maybe it is that we haven't tried hard enough, or maybe we haven't found an area that doesn't have a lot of yellow jackets, or maybe we just need to fight a little more to own our turf so that we can lie down. I don't know. But I know that this pasture of safe harbor hasn't been so safe and will never be when we look at the fundamental way that it's composed. Because it's not composed like this. It's composed like this. Do you see the difference? So thought becomes the tool of the shadow. Even a concept, if we just for a moment feel the temperature of the room, since I used that as an example, experience it fully on your skin, and experience the quality of whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, the temperature of the room for you. Or it may be neutral. Now, if you were going to leave here and tell somebody about the room temperature, what words come to mind that describe what you just experienced? You could even talk about what you thought the degree, the temperature in degrees was. But you can see, as soon as you form words that describe the experience, you're no longer based in the experience. You're in some other world. And the way we communicate is through the use of words, not embedded within the experience. If anything, the experience is only tangential to the words we use. We touch it and then flee with a whole narrative about what we just felt. We don't base ourselves in the experience. We base ourselves in the words. And from that view, the world is very cut off and very isolated. Because it's not touching what is real. It's touching the concept or the image of the experience. The image of the experience. When we live in the image of the experience, we feel isolated and separate. We feel like we feel now, most of us in this room. Have you ever had the experience that you've kind of, it's sort of like life is happening to you, but you're not really living, that it's kind of passing you by in some way, like you're on a boat or a train? Why is that? Except that we have taken up home and a reflective view of life rather than embodied within it. See, the thought is always from the outside looking in. It's always out here looking into. And therefore, it has to be separate. It cannot be lived at the same time. We give up being for knowing. We're so afraid of being that we concede to knowing. Because the thought will know the experience. But in the moment it knows it, it can't embody it. You can't be subjective and objective at the same time. And we have based all our empowerment in the objective. It's there that we have complete control. It's there that we're empowered as individuals. It's there that we can work towards our own comfort. Because we can look in at the experience and seem as if we can manipulate it. But we can never be it. And we get lonely in that isolation, in that cutting off. Because our heart, which is the embodiment of the electron's immediacy, the heart is the embodiment of the turning, of the orbital turning of the electron. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's the embodiment of the immediate, of the instantaneous. And all it needs is one concept between it and life, and it's completely blocked. It has no access, or very little access. It has a tangential access. And so, but we don't trust the heart, you see. We're too vulnerable. We're too vulnerable in the realm of the heart. Culturally, we think that is sort of a weakness. If somebody is sensitive, if somebody is heartfelt, if somebody is caring, if somebody is kind, kindness with some objectivity is what we want. And so we keep condemning the very laws that govern us. And encouraging the very separation that pains us. It's a cultural collaboration. It's a human collaboration. I don't know of any cultures that have escaped it. And the thought which created the shadow, because it put a partition between what is known and what is not known. You see? Between what is real and what is an idea. Another way of saying the same thing. The real can never be known. Remember, the real can only be lived. To know the real, we have to have an idea of the real. And therefore, we have to break ourselves away, which is the shadow. What you get from that is a sense of you and a sense of me. A sense of us. When we take that position of isolation, we also become lonely. And emotionally dry. Heartfelt, caring, empathetically, compassionately dry. So I went looking in the dictionary for the definition of a person. I said, I'll find it there. Webster will know. So Webster says, a person is the embodiment of distinctive traits of mind and behavior. Long-standing patterns or characteristics of a person, such as shyness, gregariousness, aggression, or passivity. It is the unique constellation of qualities that is a person. So I look at that and I say, okay, a person is a unique constellation of qualities. Qualities that the person wants, hopefully. And the difference is what I take myself to be, what I assume myself to be, where I rest my identity, as opposed to what I fear becoming. My personhood, my narrative, my story is around my life's experience in which these qualities are qualities I still need to work on, because that's the plot of the story. When we talk about the storyline, we have to have a plot. And the plot is where you haven't yet become what you wanted to be. So we have to work intensively the rest of our life towards evolving that plot to a decent ending. Right? And then there are the qualities that are still in you which you don't want at all. And so there is an ongoing struggle that each of us have with qualities that we want to endure and others that we want to end. And so the story, our storyline, begins to embody the embrace of our definition of personhood, our narrative. Well, if you had a mother like I had, now I've got to work on that relationship, and you see, what we're interested in doing is not transcending boundaries, but improving the boundary we're in. Home improvement. You can paint a jail cell, but you're still in prison. Most religions are about boundary improvement. All personality adjustments, most therapies, are about boundary improvement, making it a little easier for me to be in prison. But spirituality is about transcending boundaries. Let us know the difference between spiritual work and psychological well-being. It becomes immediately clear what you're doing when you hold that definition. It doesn't mean that definition of improving one's boundaries is wrong in any way whatsoever. We're not forming a new should or should not here. We just have to see the limitation of that way of working. Because the shadow uses thought as its tool to form its boundary. And it also uses thought as its tool to try to get over its boundary. It only has one tool, the tool of concept, of idea, of what I should be doing or what I must be or what I strive for or my ambition or what I have to do. So spiritual work is beginning to see, true spiritual work, is beginning to see that any use of thought or idea merely creates another boundary, a boundary that superimposes itself upon the one it's trying to fight or war against. So we fight ideas with ideas. We have a reaction, a fear response. And we try to figure out a way to get over the fear. Do you see? Or to make sure the fear never comes back again. That's how an idea tries to work, because the context of an idea can only stem from more ideas. We can only cultivate more ideas based in ideahood. So the only tool it has is ideas. So the only way the shadow can work against its own demise is towards its own growth. So let's just take an example. Pain in the knee. Right? So we have pain. And most of us would say pain was unpleasant. Suddenly, there's a drawback from the experience of pain. Where does that drawback come from? It's the shadow that's being created in the moment of pain, because if I were to give myself over to pain and have no boundary, there would be no protection from pain. Therefore, there's a pullback. In that pullback from the pain, there is the creation of I have pain, me, the owner of the pain. Now the owner of the pain can work on the pain. How? By using ideas on how to get... I have to go to the doctor. I'll wait it out. I'll be patient with it. It comes forth with ideas, because that's its embodiment. As a way to manage that which is uncomfortable. Do you see the division? Do you see the split off? Do you see the isolation? Do you see how once the entity, the sense of me, is convinced in its own truth, then it will work endlessly in the same line with the same strategies that created the boundary in the first place. Isn't that interesting? We don't know we're doing it. We don't know we're lost. There's only one strategy that the shadow has. It's to keep you based in ideas, to keep you based in concept, to keep you based in the logic of its own suffering. And it doesn't want to show, it works actively not to show you the base root cause of that suffering. Because then the whole thing would come tumbling down. So it points at the abstract. It says, since I'm divided in here and the world is out there, it must be the world that's doing it to me. It uses the sense of division to work towards its sense of completion. You're doing it to me. Or, equally as absurd and insane, I'm doing it to me. I've always been impatient. First, I've got to practice to get more patience. Then I can work on my pain in my knee. And then the logic builds up from those ideas. Once the idea has jumped off the cliff and is now free-floating, then it moves. It just reaches out in all directions. I went to a movie, Hotel Rwanda. I hope you all see it. the Hutus and the Tutsis what's so interesting is that in the 20th century, Belgium, it seemed, was a colonizing power of Rwanda. And the Belgians sort of indiscriminately picked out a group of people that they were going to allow to be the ruling class. And they picked them out by their light skin or by the shape of their nose or by some distinguishing part. So the whole became fractured. And then resentment built up from the ruling class against those which were being ruled and vice versa. Totally conceptual. They were a single culture. Indiscriminately separated. And now, a generation or more of strife and war, so that 1 million people died in this last outbreak. Based on what? The color of your eyes? Or equally as absurd, the color of your skin? That's where ideas eventually move. Because the only way you can hold an idea, the only way we can hold an idea and keep ourselves separate is to constantly reinforce the struggle of maintaining the idea. That struggle, that war, that conflict, that constriction and contraction around the idea eventually has to spill out to fight what it is that you're worrying against to keep yourself separate and distinct. Has to. And then, since time immemorial, we have created divisions within our own heart, the one heart, this heart, the spin of the electron heart, to maintain the idea and to rest in our isolation. That's been our history. Just read another Wendell Berry poem. Once there was a man who filmed his vacation. He went flying down the river in his boat with his video camera to his eye, making a moving picture of the moving river upon which his sleek boat moved swiftly toward the end of his vacation. He showed his vacation to his camera, which pictured it, preserving it forever. The river, the trees, the sky, the light, the bow of his rushing boat behind which he stood with his camera, preserving his vacation, even as he was having it, so that after he had it, he would still have it. It would be there. With a flick of a switch, there it would be. But he would not be in it. He would never be in it. Such is our condition. Such is our posture. Such is our predicament. So this is it. This is what humanity, for the most part, has done to their life. The preservation of the story, the preservation of our misery, the preservation of our retaliation and vengeance. The separation from pain and the isolation within that separation and the convincing quality that that isolation brings because ideas perpetuate themselves. Each of us is an idea of ourselves. And we've added a whole narrative that embellishes that idea so that we can stand in there with a history and know ourselves from that history. We're filming our vacation. We're not having our vacation. We're filming it. Because then we can preserve it with our continuity. Because once we have it on film, the film of our ideas, and that film of our ideas can rest safely within the vault of our memory, that proves we're continuous. That proves birth, middle age, old age, and death. But we won't go there yet, will we? Because that cuts off the storyline. So we'll deny the ending and live with the film, with the memory. I want us to see this predicament. I want us to understand what we're doing. I want us to have the courage to go into this and to see if this is the only way we can live. Is this the sum total of what life is about for us? And the drama we create around it. Why? Because we enjoy filming the steep cliffs and dark valleys of our vacation. That's where the action, that's where the plot thickens. That's where the struggles are enhanced. And as the struggles are enhanced, our storyline gets better. We have more to tell ourselves and others. And therefore, we have more definition, more refinement of a personhood, not necessarily a more pleasant person. Well, if you had a history like mine, you wouldn't expect to be pleasant or kind. And so we cast away that which is really treasured, our kindness, because our story isn't a kind story. I can't be kind. Hoping for a happy ending. If we preserve and keep taking film, someday there must be a place in that pasture where I can lie down, where there's ease and contentment, where my story will rest and be quiet. But as soon as we get close to being quiet, we create more drama because noise is the only thing we know to. Because the relief, we want relief from the quiet. Quiet represents the unknown, where we're melded, where we don't have a clear definition. So we hold ourselves away from quiet by yelling and screaming. It's called thought. So interesting. So look around us. You see, meditation is meant to begin the journey of understanding the qualities of reality and the limitation of the fixture of filming. It begins to journey us, to allow us to journey beneath the reflective gaze and our need to know. What's under there? And is it safe under there? And what's the quality or characteristics of existence once we touch it? It's a little bit like journeying to the moon. We see pictures of the moon's landscape and we say, I don't want to go there. It's gray. It's dusty. That's it. I'm out. I want color. I want some entertainment, stimulation. I'm not going there. And when we think of silence and stillness, that's what we picture the moonscape. Why would I go there? when I can have my radio, my iPod. And it's not until you go there that you see the remarkable characteristics of the moon. You see that you can lift far more weight and jump far further than you ever could on Earth. That you're light beyond measure. An ease of living. To the point where you look back from the moon and say, I don't ever want to go back there to the Earth again. What happens to us is that when we touch quietude in our meditation, we get scared. We don't feel ourselves being held in relief. The quiet doesn't offer us much. And so the fear leads us to the shadow of making quietude alien and fearful. So we stay on the safe side of sound, of definition. We don't allow ourselves to touch the beauty of what comes out in the absence of the idea. We don't allow ourselves to see our heart awaken in that new environment. To see what richness is available. The Buddha said, non-identification with anything has been declared by the Buddha, for in whatever one conceives, the fact is other than that. However we conceive anything, however our ideas hold us or hold the world around us, the fact is other than the idea. And when we move into the landscape, the lunar landscape, free of ideas, we begin to experience the interconnection of the spinning electrons. Because it's in moving in the fact, away from the shadow that has preserved our sense of presence, our sense of embodiment, presence, ego presence. We lose nothing. We gain quiet. What am I right now when I do not refer to the thought of what I am? What are we right now when we release the idea of me? When I do not live within the shadow of being this and not that? When I release myself from the narrative of my story, the figure ground shifts. Instead of the figure with the ideas leading the way of the ground of quiet, the ground of quiet comes forward and the figure of ideas fall to the background. The shift, that figure ground shift, makes everything available. Why struggle with this? Spiritual journey is learning the strategies of the shadow and refusing to play the shadow's game. It meets the objection the shadow wants with quietude. It meets the reactivity with stillness, awareness. It sees, it does not turn away. It understands, it does not object. When we learn the strategies of the shadow, we're out of the game. No more fostering more boundaries, preserving our isolation. With further struggle. Therein lies freedom from suffering. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? So if there are any comments or questions that people would like to ask, we'll... Yes. Right, so the question is, she feels a deep sense of connection when she shares her stories with friends. And at the same time, she's questioning whether that she's just maintaining and keeping the story going. And yet the same, but you feel the sense of intimacy there. Mm-hmm.
Again, like you were saying.
Yes. You know, it depends entirely upon the weight of where we put our energy. If the energy is in bringing somebody into your story so that they carry some of the burden and weight that you feel you're undeserving to have, which you can, you know, the pity, the self-pity, then that's just accentuating the problem, really. However, we're human beings and we communicate. And when we can open to the affect of the other person, so that we begin to feel what's behind the story and begin to empathize and hold that other person in our hearts through listening, and it's the ability to listen, really, then we find that intimacy is there. And often that happens in storytelling to each other, talking about our lives with one another. So it depends entirely upon how it is that we listen and how and what it is that our objective in telling the story. And so we learn how, no matter what is happening, there need not be a boundary, even if somebody is trying to bring us into their boundary through their story. Because how we listen to them, we can listen to them not through the content, but through the quality of perceiving them free of that content, their actual being, rather than the narrative that covers over that being. And you get to the point where you can go right to that area, right to that in a person. And if they want to continue to talk about that, that's fine. You know, it's not so important the further you journey on in spiritual work. But it's a nice, convenient, and socially acceptable way to get together and avoid silence, really. It's not just that. There's a warm, there's a heartwarming quality to talking, and talking can come from a friendliness and a sharing and a that's very beautiful. It's not just avoidance of that, but sometimes it is. Have you noticed, you know, when you're with somebody and there's a moment of quiet, how uncomfortable that is, and how quickly the mind rushes in that moment of quietude with all sorts of psychological presumptions, like, oh, he doesn't, you know, I'm not being interesting enough, or I'm boring because I have nothing to say, all of that. And so then we just fill it immediately with more noise so that we can maintain our persona of being interesting and whatever that means, being interesting. What does being interesting even mean? If you ever looked at that seriously, you would give it up immediately. Any other comments or questions? Yes.
The immediacy of the aliveness is, there can be a way that you can tell some interesting things about your life or where you came from, what you've done. But the immediacy is sort of for me always like in the now. What's now?
Yes.
And yet I am interested too in hearing, I love it when I hear something about a person that I never would have imagined or I didn't have any idea about it. And it makes, it's like a picture that, oh, and it gets
fuller.
Sure.
But yeah. There is something about just when you meet people telling, it doesn't interest me anymore. Right. About me, it doesn't interest me. So she says that meeting people with just the storyline is not so interesting for her anymore, and she's not so interested in maintaining that narrative going on in herself. There's less interest in her own narrative. And yet there's a beauty in just being present with someone. And there's also a beauty in finding out about that person and the things that they've done. And you see, that's what I mean by heart sharing. The narrative need not take us and divide us. It can bring us in. And it's not the full story, but it's a beautiful understanding of this organism. Especially the past narratives of all of the things, the burdens of my life, become less and less. It's not that they're rejected. It's just that they don't really have much to do with anything. And when you begin to be with someone and they're just talking from their storyline and you're connecting with them in a far different, richer way, you can see the pain that the story brings. You can see the presence of being with somebody in a different way allows you to see the pain of them holding on to the story. That opens your heart, doesn't close it. So that the ability to be compassionate and to see where somebody is stuck, and yet allowing them to be stuck. You don't say, get over your story. Because everyone has to stay in their story. I mean, that's the spiritual fix that we're all in, that we have to stay in the story until it doesn't work for us anymore. And then we're willing to release it. But as long as we still think it's working and working towards our sense of inward salvation and external identification, so that I gain a sort of identification with you and telling you my story, then we'll continue to milk that along the way. And it's okay. I mean, I listen to it all the time. And you just... But what I feel, I often don't remember any of the details whatsoever. But I remember the source of pain, how the person's configuring themselves that so that their fist is very tight and shut. And I try, if I have any, you know, I try to go in and just point to that fist. That's all I try to do. It's just look what, you know. That's all I do. But they may not want to look at it. They may want to look at the implications of the story. And so that's it. Then I become more and more respectful of the timing of the universe, not my impatience with somebody's story. Because that's just more of my shadow building. You begin to see that every aspect of mine is just shadow. And that if you go with any aspect of mine, and give any emotion credence, it's just shadow, really. You don't know. So you hold it in quiet. You feel it continues to stir in you. It feels, you know, the human being doesn't go away. It continues to, but you don't take hold of that. You don't move with it. It's like a top. And we all have spun ourselves into the cord around the top. We have spun is the storyline. And then we yank on the storyline. The top just spins, you know, and some of us are in a very fast spin. And we got a lot of spinning to do before the thing just like wears down. And says, God, this story is just so burdensome. And then falls over, right? And some of us, when we start slowing down, we find reason to wrap the rope around us and jerk it again. So that's my metaphor of the moment. Yes, Dave. Yes.
And you were, or said that therapy keeps you in your story.
Yeah. No. Some therapies can keep you in your story.
Some therapies.
Yes. It depends upon the therapist.
But therapy is all about I.
It can be. There's transpersonal therapy. There's therapies that are geared towards transcending boundaries. But most therapies, you're right, it's about solidifying or stabilizing the I, which might mean for you to challenge some of the intra-psychic shadows, areas of yourself. See, there are boundaries within boundaries. This is a concentric circles. So therapy may work very well in being able to transcend certain intra-psychic shadowed, which will allow you more pasture, which will separate the fences out so you have more room, and you think, my, and an enormous release of energy and you see yourself differently, and so there's a value to that. I'm not in any way saying that. But we're talking about, you know, the most rigid boundary of all is the boundary of self and the assumption of self. Now, all those others have to be dealt with. You can't bypass those and just come to the sense of, I want to just go with the I and crack that one open. And then you can't do it that way. You have to work with the pain that's in front of your eyes and at the understanding that you have, not the understanding of some Dharma talk you heard. You see? You have to work with your understanding, not my understanding or somebody else's understanding. So you have to work through one's own pain. And working through one's own pain, when you have the principles right, begins to show you how the boundary is formed. Not just trying to get over it and get some mental quality of calmness. You know, you're not interested in what comes rushing in when a boundary is temporarily transcended. You're interested because any boundary at some point becomes a thorn in the side. Any boundary, you become so sensitive to any sense of isolating or contraction or consolidation of self that it's just not acceptable. Not acceptable. It's acceptable in its own functionality. Not acceptable as an identifying way to be. It's acceptable as a way to introduce yourself and to navigate the world. It has a functional acceptability. It doesn't have an identification acceptability. Do you see the difference? It's very important. And so you really get to the point, and what I'm trying to do is invite all of us to look at the boundaries, whether they're boundaries of where I appreciate myself and don't appreciate myself, or boundaries of self-hatred, boundaries of... and then just keep working in that way. Not think, well, this is just psychological stuff. Learn how the boundary is formed. You learn how one boundary is formed, you know how all boundaries are formed. So you can be working on all boundaries, you might say, simultaneously working on one. It's like working on one fear when you try to learn what fear is rather than getting over the fear. If you try to get over the fear, you're just shadowing the shadow. If you learn what fear is, then all fears are equally diminished in that learning. That's very important, because we're not just trying, you know, we're not running a course of hurdles. This fear of this, and this fear of this, and this fear of this, and then I'll use behavior modification here and therapy here, and It's not that. That doesn't work. Those are just ideas that perpetuate themselves. This is far richer, far more meaningful. But it takes something from you. You have to stretch with this. We have to look deeply at what it is in terms of the mental, not in terms of my psychological content. That's just this or that. But how the mind is working in terms of, well, I mean, this in this series, we're looking at the shadow, how boundaries are formed, the formation of boundaries themselves. And then you get a whole different understanding of the mind, you see. But you have to come out of content in order to get that understanding. You can't stay enmeshed in content and work, because content is just about, hurdles. Yes. Sarah Lee, yes. Yes, yes. Saying some more about that, sure. She brings up the what I said in the talk about the spiritual journey is really allowing the ego to feel safe so they can release. Fundamentally, it's the only thing that holds itself in separation is fear, is the embodiment of fear. The embodiment of fear is the shadow. The shadow is the sense of self, the sense of I. That which is afraid to move beyond its perceived limits. So what we do in meditation is begin slowly to relax those areas of tension and resistance to see what's on the other side of that supposed fear. What's on the other side of, what if I did this, or what if I relaxed here, even though the fear is telling me I shouldn't, I relax, and you begin... And slowly, the mind wakes up to itself. It begins to see, understanding is what I call it. When we understand how the mind works, that which is understanding is the awareness, which is not embedded within the content of the mind, but free of the content. When we're just in the content of this and that and me and you and I, fear and love and hate and... then all we're going to see is content subject. But when we're aware of the processes of mind, the wanting, the fearing, the processes, that which sees the processes is not embedded in the process and can therefore understand the processes. That understanding allows the mind to relax itself, say, oh, the awareness sees the predicament and it allows the mind to release its holding. Because the mind only holds on because it doesn't know any better. What we're doing in meditation is having it learn so that it knows better. Oh, I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to keep putting myself out there egoically all the time, boosting myself up because, look, I've seen it. I know. This is known. This is seen now. You're seeing. When the Buddha was enlightened, he says, house builder, you are seen. Your ridge pole is smashed forever. You are seen. That's what we're doing in meditation. We're seeing. We're seeing. And may we all see together.